The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha.
It's all very well to say, yeah, we'll have this certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere, but if you're not talking about who's going to take the responsibility for a particular share, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yes, as the latest round of climate change talks gets underway in Durban in South Africa, we take a look at the hard science behind the soft talk at this international gathering. And
one laureate told me that her child said to her, you know, really, please don't sign so many autographs, because they'll lose their value on eBay.
Oh, goodness. With the Nobel Prize winners about to collect their gongs, Nobel Prize expert Simon France gives us a bluffer's guide to accepting this prestigious award. You know, for all you budding winners out there. And I'll be delving into some everyday small-scale science with a visit to the Hidden Heroes exhibition at the Science Museum. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great honor that I have this opportunity to accept the responsibility to preside over COP17, COP7, on behalf of my country, South Africa, and its people.
Another December, and it's another round of global talks by world leaders to try and decide what the world should do in the face of one of its biggest collective problems, climate change. With me to take us through what you need to know this week about the Durban talks are Duncan Clark from The Guardian's Environment Desk and Robin McKee of The Observer. Welcome to you both. Robin, let's start with you. You wrote a piece for The Observer on Sunday all about what you need to know about this week's talks. It's a whole series of talks happening in Durban in South Africa. The last anyone probably heard of this stuff was back in Copenhagen 2 years ago. What's been going on since? Where did we leave it back then?
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting comparison between now and Copenhagen. 2 years ago, we had all the razzmatazz and the world leaders, and this year we've got no world leaders and no razzmatazz and absolutely no expectations.
There was so much excitement 2 years ago, wasn't there?
Yes, it was. It was we're going to change the world, and absolutely nothing has happened, and nothing is very likely to happen this time either.
Well, let's not get too depressed. Hang on. So, Duncan, there was an accord signed last time. At the end of Copenhagen, there was an agreement. What was it and what's
there happened? Was an agreement of sorts. So what everyone was hoping for was a legally binding deal to reduce emissions. What they got instead was simply the promise that countries would take notice of this accord, which promised one good thing, which was that the world would try and limit the rise in temperature to 2 degrees Celsius, which is the kind of limit of safety as far as many scientists are concerned.
So what happened?
Well, what happened is that emissions continued to go up. We had a brief dip with the recession, and then they shot up even faster than everyone expected. And so what we've got now is a collective promise to try and limit the world's temperature rise to 2 degrees. At the same time, we've got emissions that are rising so fast that that target is looking increasingly implausible.
Now, Robin, the 2 degrees C target, is that one of the hopes for the Durban round of talks?
I would have said it was a hope, yes. How realistic it is, though, is a very different matter. If we want to restrict temperature rises by the end of the century to by 2 degrees, we're going to have to start thinking about peaking emissions by the end of this decade. And as you say, there's absolutely no sign of that. In fact, the very opposite is happening.
And even that's the most sort of optimistic scenario. I mean, the latest figures suggest that from the Met Office, for example, if we were to peak global emissions in 2016 and start reducing them by 3 to 4% a year, that might give us a 50-50 chance of avoiding 2 degrees. And that is way more ambitious than anything anyone is talking about at Durban or anything else, the implication being, therefore, that our chance of avoiding 2 degrees is significantly less than half.
So what's the structure of the talks this time round? I mean, who has the sort of political leadership this time, and who's sort of taking things forward?
Well, there's lots of different ways of divvying up the participants. I mean, traditionally, the way the Kyoto Protocol, which is one of the key sticking points in these round of talks, was structured was to divide countries up into developing world and developed world, as it called them, Annex A and Annex B. And the problem with that, of course, is that whereas previously, when the Kyoto Protocol was first negotiated, developing countries had relatively small emissions. Now, those countries, especially those giants like China and India, Brazil, have very large emissions. And so that traditional distinction between the developed and the developing world is starting to be, if anything, very unhelpful, because you've got countries like America who are able to say, well, we're not going to sign up for anything legally binding unless China does, because China's emissions are even bigger than ours. And yet China can turn around and say, well, that may be true, but we have more people, our emissions per capita are lower, and we generate lots of emissions by making stuff that we then export to you. And so the big sticking point really is between China and America, but that is just one example of one of the axes of tensions in the talks.
I mean, I think the power balance has shifted remarkably in the last 2 years, whereas US was seen as perhaps a major broker. I would say that China is now the one party you might see some action from this time round.
I mean, Duncan, you touched upon the issue of definitions there, and this is kind of one of the things it always comes down to. How do you define a country's emissions, which you need to do before you then start thinking, right, we're going to reduce it by X percent? You need to define that. So in the China example, they build everything for the world. They're the world's factory, essentially. And that stuff gets exported back to America, UK, wherever else. Whose emissions are they?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, in terms of measuring them, the easiest thing to do is to say that they belong to China, because that means we don't have...
And China's happy with that, I'm assuming.
Well, no. China is very unhappy with that. It's very unhappy with the fact that it exports and does a lot of the world's industry on its behalf and then gets lumbered with those emissions. And of course, that's only one of the fudges in terms of emissions. The other one is the historical responsibility. So China has something significant like 8% of global emissions if you go all the way back to 1850, when the Industrial Revolution really sort of kicked off. But what you, if you look at the UK, sorry, the, if you look at the EU and America, they have over half of the emissions emitted since 1850. So you've got historical responsibility in the mix. You've got the question of imports and exports that you just raised in the mix. You've got the difference between emissions in absolute terms and emissions per capita. All these different ways of looking at it. So there is no absolute perfect metric. I mean, what a lot of the commentators and academics now feel is that the closest we can get is what's the carbon footprint, including all the imports and excluding all the exports of each person in each country. And by that metric, something like the UK, a country like the UK, its emissions look much higher than it does in the Kyoto measurement. China looks significantly lower. Although it's worth saying that if you measure emissions that way by consumption, so taking account of everything that someone's lifestyle requires in terms of goods and services, the developing world has just overtaken the developed world, which is a little known fact just about to be published. And so again, we've got this blurring of the situation where the developing world feels it's not responsible, but purely in terms of numbers, increasingly it's the majority share.
And that's a cumulative thing, is it? For which countries are involved in that?
Well, that is developing and developed as defined by Kyoto. So that's, I mean, roughly speaking, that's Europe and America and Australia versus the rest of the world. So it's not surprising that those countries, the developing countries, have huge emissions because they represent the majority of the world's populations. However, if you are trying to reach an agreement politically, it makes it very difficult for the developed world to just say, well, we'll take all the leadership, even if they do have greater responsibility historically, when the developing world is the majority of the emissions picture.
There's a huge assumption of also that it's just between those two those two sort of blocks, as it were, of the growing developing nations and then let's call them the West, of the legacy nations. But what about all the ones in the middle, the small nations, the ones that are actually going to face a lot of these problems? What say do they have, and are they actually going to have any impact upon these talks?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the fact that the talks are in Africa is, of course, symbolically important because Africa is absolutely in the front line of climate change. And these are countries which have very limited negotiating power and economic muscle. And so far, those countries have had very minimal input into the talks. And I think the fact that we're seeing this round in South Africa may change that a little bit. You've got other countries like the Maldives, the small islands, the low-lying islands, which face the possibility of being completely inundated with seawater in 100 years or so. They're pushing not just for 2 degrees, but for limiting temperature rise at 1.5 degrees. So they're already asking for something far more ambitious than the rest of the world are looking like they might just let go.
I mean, the Maldives are famous, and the government is famous for it sort of stunts in this particular world. I mean, in this particular area, there's that time when they had the entire cabinet meeting underwater. But do you think it makes any difference, any of this sort of stuff?
Well, I think the interesting thing about the Maldives is that they do those stunts, but they've also done something far more significant, which is to say, in order to show leadership and show what can be done, we're going to try and reduce our emissions to effectively zero or thereabouts within 10 years. And they announced that last year. And so hopefully, you know, by 2020, we'll have the first example of a country that's gone fairly close to carbon neutral.
So whatever the deal is that comes out of this, and we'll talk in a second from both of you what you think success is. But whatever the deal is, what are the steps necessary? What do they need to agree in terms of global carbon budgets and how to divvy them up? I mean, what's the sort of steps in the way to doing that?
Well, we've done step one, which is to agree a broad target of 2 degrees as the maximum upper end acceptable for temperature rise. The next stage should be, if you were to take it in logical steps, would be to say, okay, in order to try and stay within that envelope of warming, how much carbon can we all collectively emit? Now, that's the crucial missing stage. In the earlier parts of the Copenhagen conference, the so-called Danish text, which was exposed and then thrown out, said, well, they had at least one specific point in the direction of a global emissions budget, which was to say we will try and limit temperature. We will try and cut emissions in such a way that global emissions peak by 2020. That was thrown out, which means at the moment we've got no guide at all to what the world thinks its global emissions budget should be. I think simply agreeing that, saying however many gigatons it should be, or a date of peak and a rate of decline thereafter, would be probably the best single outcome we could expect from this.
And then
talks.
Then you could then divvy that up accordingly, depending on whatever politics you want to use.
Well, exactly. I just think separating the two problems would be helpful, because at the moment we're trying to do two things at once: agree how much carbon the world can emit, and agree who gets how much of that carbon. And I think that's blurring the waters somewhat. If we just said, okay, well, we've agreed the temperature target, now let's agree the emissions budget, and then let's squabble about who gets what. And I think that would be a slightly clearer process.
Robin, in your sort of a reading of this, what would be a successful, and I'm using air quotes there, successful outcome?
I think a successful outcome would be some kind of acknowledgement of divvying up. I think that's at least there has to be a talk about it. And so far there isn't. It's all very well to say, yeah, we'll have this certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But if you're not talking about who's going to take the responsibility for a particular share, you're not going to get anywhere.
And how close are we to that?
Not very close at all.
I mean, this is always the sort of billion-dollar question, isn't it, with these talks. You might get some sort of accord, you might get some sort of people saying, we promise to look at these things in future, but are we any closer now than we were 2 years ago to any sort of global deal?
I would have said we're further back.
We're further back.
I think we are. We're further back. And slightly worryingly, a growing number of commentators are starting to say, oh, well, what will it look like without a global deal? Maybe we can do this in a more bottom-up way with countries pressing ahead with their own initiatives. The problem with that is that all the initiatives they point to have been going on as, you know, examples of good practice, more clean energy in China or whatever, but it's been going on in parallel with exponentially rising emissions. And that's the thing we need to worry about. It's all very well building more clean energy capacity, but that's in itself doesn't solve the problem. The problem is the amount of fossil fuels we burn.
I mean, a lot of people are talking now and saying, well, yeah, two degrees is inevitable. What would it be like if, how can we stop 4?
So people are actually seriously discussing this now?
Yes.
And we're talking about losing many coastal cities and more floods, more
deserts,
more storms,
spreading
deserts
across Africa, yeah. But the question is, can we go to 4? Can we save the rainforests?
I want to talk just maybe finally a bit about politics here. Clearly, this is a deeply political conversation that's going on. Duncan, you mentioned China versus the US in terms of huge numbers of emissions, growing emissions, and both of them saying, the other one's not reducing them, so we're not going to do it either. Is there something else going on underneath that? I mean, there must be something more than just, oh, well, what happens if China decided tomorrow we're going to cut every single fossil fuel? Would America jump in line?
Well, I think that's a really important question because, I mean, at the end of the day, you've got a Congress in the States dominated by Republicans who largely don't believe that climate change exists. So while America at the moment can turn around and say, well, we're not doing anything because of China and India and Brazil, that seems to me a little bit disingenuous. And also, I wouldn't be surprised if the same is true the other way around. China likes to say, we'd cut our emissions if only, you know, the Americans and the Europeans would take the lead. And yet, if they did that and they, you know, gave the Chinese what they wanted, would they be happy there to make firm caps on their own emissions. My suspicion is probably not, judging by the fact that at Copenhagen, the Chinese did whatever they could to block even the targets for the developed world. So I wouldn't be surprised if, behind the scenes, really, China and America are using each other as a bit of an excuse to avoid the fact that they have these huge coal reserves, and if we sign up for a global deal, they're not going to be able to use
them. They have the biggest coal reserves in the world, in fact, both of those countries.
Exactly, along with India, yeah.
I don't quite... Well, I certainly agree with you totally about America. I think the interesting thing might be China. China has made a lot of moves to more renewable energy practices in the last couple of years. It may decide that it, you know, it wouldn't mind being the country that makes all these renewable energy sources in future, in which case there is a market for it.
There is, absolutely.
Calling for a reduced emissions, in which case it may then confront America, and America could find itself blindsided. I'm not saying that's going to happen this time, though.
Well, I mean, I think that's the great hope, really, is that China, as the world's biggest emitter, which is still increasing its emissions, unless China is on board, then... You know, there's almost no point in trying. So the great hope has to be that China will really embrace renewable energy, not just as a manufacturer, but also as a user. The problem, of course, is that if you look at what's happening with emissions, the rate of increase is higher in China than it is everywhere else. So we've got a big tension there that at the moment shows no sign of being resolved.
Well, Duncan, Robin, thank you very much for all of that. For rolling coverage of the Durban Climate Talks, just go to guardian.co.uk/environment. And now for something entirely different. Later this week, the 2011 Nobel Prizes will be handed out in the presence of the King of Sweden. As you might expect, it will be a grand affair. So grand, in fact, that we thought we'd invite Nobel Prize expert Simon France, creator of the Nobel Prize Watch blog, to give any budding Nobel laureates out there a heads up on how to accept their awards with style. Simon, welcome back.
Hello.
So Simon, tip number one, you're suggesting that our future laureates get as much sleep as possible beforehand.
That's right, it's going to be a long week. It's not just the 10th of December that they're there for. They're there for approximately 1 week, which involves press conferences, Nobel lecture, official interviews, champagne receptions, Nobel Prize concert, university visits, TV companies after you, newspapers after you. It's a long, long time, and it's almost 24/7.
So in a sense, you are a rock star celebrity.
This is true. I've talked to laureates about this, and they say it's like the Super Bowl and the Academy Awards all rolled into one. They've never seen anything like it before. They're recognised on streets. People want their autographs. It's an incredible week they have.
Tip number two. This whole thing is meant to work like a Swiss watch. And your suggestion to the future laureates, Simon, is go with the flow.
Yeah, just relax and go with it. This has been organised for decades, and everybody there knows what they're doing. The Nobel Foundation know exactly what to do. They cater for all eventualities. Talking about celebrity lifestyle, you turn up there and you receive your limousine, a Volvo naturally, and you have an attaché that's hired from the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. And it's someone who speaks your mother tongue and guides you through the whole week of events. So, and your itinerary is put down to the very minute. So it's like 8 o'clock, get up, 8:30, appear for breakfast, 9 o'clock, pick up in the car.
You've only got half an hour for breakfast.
Yeah.
My goodness.
I know, yeah. This is it.
You have to wolf this down. Yeah. Better not have indigestion.
Or better not go for the huge Swedish breakfast.
No, quite.
9:30, arrive for your tuxedo fitting. 10:30, go to university for a visit. It's all down to the minute. So relax. They know what they're doing. Sit in the back of your limousine and watch the world go by.
And does this have any lasting effects when these guys get home?
Well, apparently it does. Because imagine if you had this service for a week, what it's like going back to the real world. I mean, there's one story about a physics laureate who got off the plane after Nobel week, got into his car, sat in the back of the car, waiting to be taken somewhere. Wait there for quite some time, apparently.
Was he meant to be driving himself
around? Yes, he was.
Fantastic. So, tip number three. You're going to be a celebrity for a week. We've touched on this already, but give us a sense of how famous these guys actually are in that week.
These are people who've existed in university corridors most of their life, and now they're about to get the red carpet treatment. There's going to be photographers and autograph hunters outside the Grand Hotel where they are. They're going to be recognised on the streets by people. They're going to have their photographs in newspapers everywhere. It really is a cultural shift for them.
Isn't it a lovely thing, though, that famous scientists and political activists and things are the ones who are celebrating in celebrity ways rather than the usual celebrities, film stars and things?
I think it's brilliant. I think it's a shame it only lasts for a week. I think one laureate told me that he was instantly recognisable for 1 week, and then his fame when he got back home was like the character who sits in the second row of a coffee commercial.
So what happens to these guys? Do they sort of have to suffer the same ignoble fates as other celebrities? Are they criticised for their dress? Are they sort of followed around and papped?
In the newspapers leading up to the banquet, they'll have photographs of each of the laureates and their wives and family, and they even have
or husbands,
or husbands indeed, and but not this year, And they'll have a plan of the lead table in the banquet, and they'll say who's going to have interesting conversations, who's going to have less interesting conversations, and the partners of the laureates' dresses are rated the morning after, like in the Oscars, and they get that 5-star rating. It really is quite a strange world for scientists to step into.
And there must be scuffles for autographs as well.
Oh, there are. People do compete for autographs. I mean, one laureate told me that her child said to her, you know, really, please don't sign so many autographs because they'll lose their value on eBay.
Oh, goodness. Tip 4.
Your Majesties, Your Royal Highnesses, Honoured Laureates, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Nobel Foundation, I would like to welcome...
How to behave and how not to behave. There's, I'm assuming, lots and lots of protocol here.
There is a huge amount of formality and protocol here because the ceremony is in front of the King and Queen of Sweden. The banquet is a state banquet, and you have to do all the things you do at these official events. One thing that people may not know is that before the prize ceremony, each of the laureates has to go to rehearsal where they learn how to go up to the King, receive the prize and diploma, and then walk back.
Doesn't sound too hard.
No, it doesn't sound too hard. And you'd think, of all the people who could do this, Nobel laureates should be able to do this, right? Yeah. But, you know, once you're there on stage and you have to go up there and everybody's looking at you, you know, these thoughts take over your mind.
Is there a particular order of things you have to do up there? Yeah. Just pick it up and take it away?
No, you can't just run up, take it, say thanks very much and go back. You have to wait for your turn. You have to wait for the fanfare. You walk up to the middle of the carpet, which has a big N insignia, which is Nobel Foundation. The King meets you there. You shake his hand. You receive the medal and diploma, which apparently is heavier than you might think.
So be prepared.
Yeah, be prepared. Work out
practice
beforehand.
With a heavy book or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You bow to the King. Then you bow to the audience of laureates and Nobel Prize Committee members behind you. And then you bow to the audience and you walk back.
Now, how does this go wrong?
It can go wrong, yeah. Well, but when you say wrong, people get their hands muddled up and forget to bow in the right places and all
and
that.
Drop the thing and yeah, they rolls along.
Oh yeah,
the
it's a huge embarrassment when people realise they've not bowed to the right people in the right order and things like that.
And how excited can you get? Can you do a sort of King of the World sort of jumping up in the air, or are you meant to be very restrained?
You are supposed to be restrained, but there are a few laureates that have used the moment to express their excitement. There's one well-known example of our very own Sir Paul Nurse, who, when he received the prize, he bowed to the audience and he raised his hand as if he won the World Cup. You know, both hands above his head, and then walked back and thought that was quite... He was just appreciating the audience, really. He thought that all the audience were being very kind and very, very nice to him, so I thought I'd recognise that. But apparently, when they do the rehearsals for future laureates, apparently they showed a video to them, and part of the video is what not to do. And apparently Paul Nurse was told that they showed him receiving the prize.
He's the object lesson of what not to do.
He's the lesson of what not to do.
Excellent. Tip number 5.
Very welcome to the Nobel Banquets of 2010. Here at the City Hall in Stockholm, inside the Blue Hall, centre of the Nobel festivities since the 1970s.
Pace yourself, it's going to be a long, long day.
It is. The 10th of December is a very long day for the laureates. You go to the prize ceremony, which is in the afternoon, and then you go straight from the prize ceremony to the banquet, which begins at 7, and then after the banquet you go upstairs and you indulge in a spot of dancing. And then you tend to leave around 11 midnight and then go to the secret after-show party, which is at a university in Stockholm, and that lasts until about 4 or 5 in the morning.
And once again, to outline the celebrity status of all this, I mean, this is something that's broadcast live on Swedish TV, and there's people commentating, and there's food pundits, and all sorts of things.
The banquet's incredible. Swedish families sit in front of their TV and watch this live every year. They have food pundits, they have style pundits commentating on this, as you would on the Oscars. They have interviews with the family members. I remember Sir Martin Evans' granddaughter being interviewed live on Swedish TV. And it's just an incredibly formal, swanky occasion.
In the same way that the whole week is a Swiss-timed operation, the actual serving is a Swiss-timed operation, isn't it?
It's incredible. They have 45 chefs. They have 260 servers. They serve 400 champagne bottles, 400 wine bottles. And everybody receives their course within the same minute or so of each other. It's a remarkable feat of operation. If you ever watch the videos of this, you can see that a swarm of waiting staff coming down the stairs with everyone's food.
What I'm slightly perturbed about is the fact that for 1,300 people, there's only 400 wine bottles. It doesn't sound like a very, you know, drink-soaked affair.
It's not a Guardian Christmas party, is it?
No, there'll be zero champagne or wine bottles for the 1,300. We'd be looking for them. No, but is that on purpose? Was there a drunken laureate once or something?
I don't know about that, but I think they know that it's going to be a long night, and so they everything is very well paced. You know, you celebrate, but you don't overindulge.
Tip number 6. I like the mambo, mambo, mambo. I like the cha 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 cha. You can't just leave straight after the ceremony.
No, if you leave after the 10th, you're missing out on a lot of the fun part. Well, after the 10th, things tend to wind down a bit, and you know, laureates fulfil most of their official duties. Even though the only duty they're supposed to fulfil by stipulation is to deliver the Nobel lecture. Everything else is
optional.
Optional.
But yes. Why wouldn't you go to a party?
Why not? Indeed.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the day after the event, there's a smaller sort of cozy affair with the royal family at the royal palace, where it's just for the laureates and their family. But on the 13th is the most interesting day for people, because it's the feast of Santa Lucia, which is a very, very well celebrated feast day in Sweden. So it's to celebrate light in the darkness during winter. Laureates get woken up in bed in the morning in the Grand Hotel with women with white flowing robes and candles in their hair, and serving them special Santa Lucia buns.
And what? And they think they've been executed overnight. This is heaven, finally. The angels have turned up. So who are these people that just sort of walk into their rooms and wake them up?
Oh, they're Swedish children who are dressed up and there as part of the official Santa Lucia.
They have candles in their hair.
They do, yeah.
And they serve them what? Buns?
Buns. They're saffron buns.
Okay. And then what happens the rest of that day? Are there more events?
Well, there's a party in the evening for the science laureates. There's one party at the Karolinska Institute for the medicine laureates. There's another party at the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences for physics and chemistry laureates. And this is where everything calms down a bit. And you still wear your white tie, but everything is much more informal.
This is the third night of partying, by the way.
This is the third night of partying. Well, actually, this isn't the third night of partying. This is the umpteenth night of partying.
Okay.
Because you've been doing it since you've arrived. But this is where everything becomes more relaxed, and it's all full of students, and the laureates get to let their hair down. And a lot of laureates say they like that, because they've gone through everything which has been quite formal and very ceremonial. And as good as that is, it's good to let your hair down, and it's good to have the fun taken out of you a bit. So then the laureates have to get up on stage and sing special songs, which there are special Swedish songs for drinking, especially schnapps. And for the physics and chemistry laureates, they get inducted into a very peculiar order called the Order of the Ever-Smiling and Jumping Green Frog.
What the hell is that?
Well, they have to get up on stage, they have to sing a song, they get a frog medallion put around their neck, and they have to make noise like a frog and jump.
So Richard Feynman's done this?
Yes, amongst many others. And he was particularly proud of this moment, of all his memories in his Nobel week, because he recalls reading Aristophanes' play The Frog when he was a kid, and he spent ages trying to get the frog sound right that was in that verse. And he said he never realised it would become useful until he went up to get his Nobel Prize.
I think you can't add anything else to that point. Simon France, thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, it's a complex muscle pump that basically is driving the body and keeping the relevant organs alive. And often, obviously, when it's sick and it needs surgery, the anaesthetic that I'm having to give to allow that surgery to take place is not very good for the heart. Blood pressure disappears, the heart doesn't like to pump terribly well, and also the rhythm of the heart can be quite badly disturbed by some of the drugs I give. So it's an incredibly challenging, exciting, pressured job trying to combine the anaesthetic with actually keeping the heart pumping and the patient alive.
That was a taster of our interview with anaesthetist Bruce Martin, who's the next expert to be featured in our Affairs of the Heart series in association with the British Heart Foundation. If you want to watch all the videos in that series, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. Now, here on Science Weekly, we like to think we bring you the big ideas. But for a long time now, a certain type of science geek, best described as an inventor, has tended to figure out the small but perfect solutions to everyday life problems, leaving the big conceptual stuff to prospective Nobel laureates, of course. These hidden heroes are being celebrated in a new exhibition at the Science Museum in London. I went along to find out a bit more.
This is an exhibition that we are hosting from the Vitra Design Museum in Germany. It contains 36 stories of everyday objects that you use in everyday life, are produced in their billions, and probably you don't even think about where they came from and who actually invented them.
So these include things like paper clips and ballpoint pens and corkscrews and all of those things that actually... You do wonder, you think, oh, I've never thought about the fact that it's actually invented, or it's just something that someone dug out of the ground one day, but clearly there's a story behind each of them. Let's go into one or two of them in a bit more detail. First up, the earplug.
Where did that come from?
Well, there was a gentleman called Maximilian Negwer who was inspired by the Odyssey and Odysseus, who had to block his ears so that he didn't hear, he wasn't tempted by the singing of the sirens. And he developed these wax earplugs for hearing protections around 1907. And originally these were surrounded by cotton wool, but as time moved on, plugs were made of wood, celluloid, which I love actually because it might well have been as an inflammable material, and hard rubber. But of course today, most are made of foam rubber. And of course, if you go to a pop concert, you might well be bringing your own or be giving them at the door.
And you can't, it's one of those things you think, well, what we've done without them, because they've probably protected hundreds of millions of ears.
Absolutely. And of course, we're far more conscious now of noise pollution as we live in cities. Protecting your hearing against loud noises, it becomes ever more important. So I think it becomes one of those devices that we will use, every one of us, at some point in our lives.
Okay, let's move on to the barcode. This is the ubiquitous series of penguin-esque lines that go across nearly every single object you buy, see, touch, feel. Where did they come from?
Again, it was an American gentleman, Norman Woodland, and his colleague Bernard Silver, who invented this in America in the 1950s. And they wanted to produce a unified coding system. And interestingly enough, it was one of the largest voluntary cooperative projects that had ever been implemented in the commercial world. Of course, now it's been replaced by, it's got a rival in something called the Quick Response Code. And that was developed by a Japanese corporation in the 1990s. And again, why it's important, it can actually carry 10 times, 100 times as much data as a flat barcode, because of course it's in two dimensions.
And the quick response codes, they're these QR codes that are on sort of square QR codes that look like pixelated diagrams, and they, I suppose, contain, as you say, 100 times more information, usually linking to websites or something. That's just shows that these things keep developing.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, if you've got a sort of iPhone, an app, you're going to be having apps that respond to those. It's going to become ever more important for people because they can actually use their iPhone and then use those quick response codings to actually get an application that years ago they wouldn't even been aware of or been able to get hold of.
It's interesting, actually, that was invented in 1994, the QR code, given that it's now 2011, we're just about seeing them in practice. It takes, how long it takes to get them into the world is quite interesting as well. All right, well, let's move on to something much more, well, I want to say mundane, but actually probably very useful for anyone spending a weekend doing DIY. This is the roll plug. How would you get things into the wall without one of these?
Well, I think it's very interesting. This is one of the British stories in the exhibition. There was an engineer, John Joseph Rawlings, who was working at the British Museum. He was a contractor installing some electrical fittings. And before his invention, he used to have to chisel a large hole in the wall, plug it with a piece of wood and mortar, and then screw the fitting into the wooden plug. He actually developed the roll plug, the thing that everybody, the DIY fans of today, could not do without.
Just tell us what the roll plug is for anyone who might not have seen it.
Well, it's a sort of it's a plastic tube that actually, as you, it's what is it called? It says grip by expansion. That's how it works. It was made originally of jute fibres, saturated with glue, and later on there was a chap called Arthur Fischer, a German inventor, who developed the plastic version as well, which I think probably is the one that we're most familiar with. Again, since 1958, 20 billion examples have been sold. So this is a massive world market for something that you really wouldn't even think about. You just use it every day and don't even think somebody actually invented that.
And so this is obviously to keep pictures and everything else on the walls by allowing you to screw into there and without damaging the wall too much. That was the main idea.
I think so. That was again it. But again, so to have somebody's name forever, ever immortalised in a building appliance, I think that's quite fun. And also it's a British story, which is rather nice too.
What's your favourite or what's the product that you want to tell everyone about after you've seen them all?
Well, I think it's the rubber band. I just think it's so utilitarian, it's so interesting. It was patented in 1845, exactly, 2 years later than the first patent for the vulcanisation of rubber. But again, there's a bit of a story behind that. It was the work of somebody called Steve Perry, who was working for the entrepreneur of natural rubber, Thomas Hancock, who worked out how to vulcanise rubber, building on the work of Charles Goodyear. And Thomas Hancock made a lot of money. Charles Goodyear, whose probably idea it really, really was, because I think Thomas Hancock had a sneak preview, was not. He was pipped at the post by Thomas Hancock. And actually, sadly enough, whereas Hancock made a fortune out of his invention, Charles Goodyear went bankrupt. He was an American and died in poverty. So it was quite interesting that how success in an invention can turn on a flip of a coin, or just making sure that you submit your patent before your competition.
He does have a tyre company named after him, of course.
It's not actually linked directly with him. He actually led quite a long, tragic life, so it might well be his descendants, but it's not his business, strangely enough. But everybody thinks that, but that's not so.
That's a good factoid there. he didn't invent, well, he wasn't behind the rubber tyres. So then the rubber band, where did that, what was the idea behind it, I suppose? Is that a silly question?
Well, again, it was that once you actually can produce this modified rubber material, what do you do with it? I mean, Thomas Hancock produced a book, The Story of Caoutchouc, i.e. natural rubber. He talked about all the marvellous uses of his materials. But again, you've got an elastic material that's actually functional, and because you've added sulphur to it by vulcanisation, it has a bit more longevity, and it's not natural rubber. It's, hot and sticky in the warm and goes sort of cold and brittle in the cold. But once you've added sulphur to it, it's a manipulable material. So you've got a right material at the right time, and Steve Perry was working with Thomas Hancock, and he actually worked that this was a machine we could do something quite interesting with, and so the rubber band was born.
For more information on the exhibition, which runs until June 2012, visit the museum website sciencemuseum.org.uk. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.